Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
Bandwidth for Triangulation is brought to you by CacheFly at CacheFly.com.
This is Triangulation, episode 139, recorded February 10th, 2014. Brett Martin and Difficult Men. Triangulation is brought to you by Lynda.com. Learn what you want when you want with access to over 2,000 high-quality online courses and training videos, all for one low monthly price. To try it free for 7 days, visit lynda.com/triangulation. That's lynda.com/triangulation. And by Personal Capital. With Personal Capital, you'll finally have all your financial life in a single place and get a clear view of everything you own. Best of all, it's free. To sign up, go to personalcapital.com/triangulation. It's time for Triangulation, the show where we get the most interesting, smartest, most stimulating people on the internet in to talk about their work, their ideas. It's always a lot of fun. I'm really glad you're here today because I've got a guest I'm very personally excited about talking to, and I think you will be too when you find out what we're going to talk about. Brett Martin is a writer at GQ. His work has appeared in the Vanity Fair and the New Yorker, New York Times. He won the James Beard Award for journalism for a profile of Danny Bowien and the Mission Chinese Food in New York City. But I discovered him through his most recent book, which I love. It's called Difficult Men, Behind the Scenes of a Creative Revolution from The Sopranos and The Wire to Mad Men and Breaking Bad. I listened to it on Audible, so I don't have a hardcover to hold up. But man, if you are interested in, television, acting, writing, this is a great book to read. Brett, welcome to
Thank
the Triangulation.
Thank you. Great very, to very talk happy to be here.
How did this come about? I get the feeling that you were behind the scenes at The Sopranos. It almost feels like you're in the writer's room on The Wire and Mad Men.
Well, I actually spent very little time in. I recreate a lot of writers' rooms in the book. I did spend some time right around the time of the last season of The Sopranos. I was hired by HBO to write a companion book, which I was hesitant to do, frankly, because it was that genre isn't necessarily the highest brow genre you'll ever get, but they made it very clear that they wanted it to be treated like a work of journalism. And in fact, I was invited to really spend time on the set during that last season. I wasn't a television writer. I'd done some Hollywood writing as part of my magazine work. But I showed up at the Silver Cup Studios in Queens, where this was taking place. And what I found was kind of the what I describe in the book is kind of the white hot center of pop culture at that moment. I mean, there was no place more exciting to be than there at that sort of height of what The Sopranos was doing. And as a commercial artist myself, that's what I was sort of turned on by. I mean, I was surrounded by people who had been working in television for many, many years. We're all aware that they were doing probably the best work of their life, that they may not have even ever expected to be able to do anything they could be proud of. And I got to watch James Gandolfini act, which was, you know, one of the great pleasures of my life, great privileges I've ever had. And it made me feel as though something was happening. Something serious was happening. And frankly, at this point, I think we all, it almost seems too obvious to talk about that television has become an art form.
Yes.
But at the time, it was still something of a novelty. And so when I went back to working for magazines, I began to, you know, I continued to talk to these guys who became sort of who I argue is sort of the signature role of this movement is this this new kind of auteur, the showrunner, the kind of autocratic showrunner. And the more of them I met, the more fascinating I found them. And then it sort of became a book.
You say we're in the third golden age of television.
Right.
And I almost think that doesn't do it justice because television historically is really a middle brow medium. And in fact, the vast majority of TV still is very middle brow.
Right.
But what happened, and you point this out, this really began with The Sopranos in the late 90s, is that these great writers, now David Chase, who created The Sopranos, was not a great writer. If you looked at his previous work, he was very middle brow. He wrote for, you know, what were the shows he wrote for? I mean,
well, I mean, for television, he was quite accomplished. People remember Northern Exposure.
Yeah, that was a great. But he hated that.
He hated it. Yes, I mean, the truth of the matter is that nobody could be harder on David Chase than David Chase himself. You know, by any normal measure, he had actually had a very good.
He was a successful television writer who had never. Absolutely. But his love was movies, and he felt like writing for TV was slumming.
Slumming, prostitution, as harsh a self-judgment as you can possibly imagine. He had it. He was afflicted, and you know, one of the great dramas of the book, I think, is the question of whether he's even now, having accomplished what he did with The Sopranos, gotten over it, with the worst ideas of what television was. He had been raised during the sort of golden age of American movies, and to do television was selling out. It was being the worst kind of hack. And every time I met with him over the course of, you know, what turned into about 5 years, from the time I met him working on that first book till the end of this book, I would always ask, you know, well, are you happy now? Have you have any reason to change your mind now? And because frankly, that became my own obsession is, you know, will this guy ever, I call him the reluctant Moses of the golden age, and that he sort of opened the doors to the promised land, but could never enter himself. And I think by the end, spoiler alert, he achieved some level of satisfaction.
But, I hope so. He started for writing Kolchak, The Night Stalker, wrote 13 episodes of The Rockford Files. He was a classic television writer. Yes, Northern Exposure. Yes, I'll Fly Away, which was...
That's even more so, yeah.
Yeah, but what's interesting is, first of all, he's a writer. He became a showrunner, which is a very, as you point out in the book, a very, very different job. But it was the beginning of these very talented writers creating and running shows like The Wire, like Mad Men, like Breaking Bad, and taking on a whole new role that perhaps they were ill-prepared for, and eventually turning this kind of television into the art form that surpassed movies.
Right.
I mean, movies, you have 2 hours. It's an episode. It's not a story. I can't remember who it was. Was it Milch? Who would bring in novelists to work on...
David Simon.
For The Wire.
For The Wire, yeah.
For The Wire. Right. He brought in novelists, and he said, look, this is more like writing a novel. Each show is a chapter. You're going to get 13 hours, 26 hours. You're going to get 68 hours, in the case of Breaking Bad, to tell a story.
Right, right.
And no movie can ever do that.
No, and no writer of movies, even you know, we fetishize the role of the director in film as this great auteur. I make the point, and I believe it, that they would kill for a tiny fraction of the amount of power that say David Chase ruled over, held over this universe of The Sopranos, which of course went on for 82
six
hours,
yeah,
something,
yeah.
You know, and could expand, and you could bring in whole new cities, and you know, they move to New York, and there's a whole new gang, and I mean, it is really, you know, it's very hard to, whenever you talk about showrunners, you wind up using the language of divinity, because they really are
the gods. Creator.
They are the creator, and they move characters around on the board, and it's as close to. And not only that, it's even more than a novelist. You know, they invent a scene, and then there's carpenters who build it, and there's
right.
there's you know, a whole corporate division goes into action to make their imaginings real.
That was one of the things that made Simon crazy, was that the writer who last worked on the script would get the Emmy award, even though in almost every case it was the showrunner who created the story, put it together. And then assign it to a writer to just, as you say, as like a carpenter, you know, finish the walls.
Well, that's sort of another issue altogether, in that the great paradox is that with the reason a writers the reason that writers are the kings on television, kings and queens, and mostly kings, but
now queens in some respects. We're seeing more women, you know.
Right. But
Jenji Kohan with Weeds. Although, as you point out in the book, the women seem to get the half hour comedies, right. And the men get the hour.
Somehow get a half hour, and that's still true with girls and
girls and Veep,
and Veep exactly. Yeah. That power is derived. Listen, as you, I think you were beginning to allude to, writers aren't necessarily the best managers. They're not necessarily the best budget keepers. Their power derives almost entirely from the fact that television is this relentless beast that needs to be fed constantly, and only the writer can feed it. Content is, you must have the next week's story, and so more than any, that is why corporations will suddenly empower the least likely people to empower in the world, which is writers. As one, I can tell you that.
So ill prepared.
One of the great things about this moment is that it's this rare moment when writers ascend to the top. The problem with that, and the paradox, is that it's too much for any one writer to do alone.
Right.
And so what you have is this invention of this what I argue is this kind of great creative space called the writer's room, which is kind of the central scene of this golden age. And it's the tension between auteurism and collaboration, necessary collaboration, that I think animates so much of the story, but both what you see on screen and behind the scenes.
There's so many wonderful moments in this book, but you talk about the writer's room it's one of the Milch.
Deadwood?
Was it Deadwood?
Well, I was in the room for his sec for Locke.
Milch,
but it was essentially his method for.
Milch had an unusual system for going through scripts. Describe that.
Well, unusual only begins to explain it. I was going to say that each writer sort of has to invent the writer's room that suits him best, him or her best. Milch's is really from space. I mean, it's it's essentially a séance. He was very kind enough to invite me in to watch. And what he does is he gathers young writers, mostly female, around him, and reclines. He has a bad back, and he reclines in the center of a room with a screen in front of him and a transcription person, someone who's writing down everything he says. And he extemporizes the script out loud, while in the presence of this what I call the Vestal Virgins, this kind of seance is really the best way I can put it. And somehow this creative, it's in some ways this incredible piece of self-aggrandizing theater. You can't believe it. But it works. It works for him. He has a very well documented obsessive compulsive tendencies. He's an ex addict, and for whatever reason, this way of working has allows him to break free of those and to create. Now, watching it is one of the most bizarre things you'll ever see, because it's what goes on in any of our heads as we write. Is this word better than this word? Back up. Here's a comma instead of a period, and except that it's all being done out loud as this kind of performance art. That is as unusual as it gets, but it is an extreme example of how the writer's room is a kind of accommodation that each showrunner has to invent anew each time.
We should give him full credit. David Milch wrote for Hill Street Blues, created NYPD
sure.
Blue. Deadwood was quite an amazing thing, and you tell how the script was being written pretty much as the show was being shot.
Right.
Just crazy. He did Luck, which I thought was, with Dustin Hoffman, an amazing show, which died a very rapid death.
Yeah, that was an unusual situation. I agree that it was much better than his previous follow-up, John from Cincinnati, which really, even the people on, I talked to producers on that, nobody on that set knew what that show was about, including the writers, as far as I can tell. Luck.
Had some bad luck.
Luck had bad luck. There were some sort of tragic deaths of the horses.
It was about horse racing and betting.
Exactly.
It had such promise, but three horses died on the set, and I think that was enough to
Right. If you want to be cynical about it, you can point out that Three Horses died on the set and the ratings weren't particularly good.
Right. Let's talk about ratings, because even something like Mad Men, which is a cultural phenomenon and a success, gets a fraction of the ratings of a successful show like American Idol on a major network.
Right. Right. As a matter of fact, it's funny that I take back what I just said about ratings, only insofar as I think at a certain point, of course, ratings are still a part of the picture here.
They have to be. You have to make
money. But in the big picture, if you had to point to what allowed this moment in history to take place, nothing is as important as the diminishment of the importance of ratings.
And that's because HBO is a subscription channel.
Right.
Made its money on subscriptions. And that's how the Sopranos would not have happened without that situation.
Absolutely. It's sort of easy to see in the case of HBO, because they only need to watch 1 hour a month and then they're happy. So they don't have that traditional cooling effect of what do the sponsors want? What are they afraid there's going to be violence or sex up against their soap commercial? It's sort of the first, it's no accident that this golden age began on a station for which ratings were always secondary.
Right.
What gets really interesting, I think, is when that same principle made the jump to basic cable, which is to say that all of a sudden, these networks realize that in a landscape in which there is infinite, nearly infinite choice of viewing options, it was less important to have the most people watch your show than to basically exist at all. I mean, you began to have a situation where if AMC doesn't have an identity, a brand, if FX doesn't distinguish itself from every other of the thousands of channels out there, it ceases to exist. Your local cable company drops it. So within a certain amount of reason, you could have a show that not all that many people watch, as long as they were talking about it, as long as people knew what AMC was, knew what FX was. And it turns out that the way to do that is through original programming and through empowering creative people. And that's really the kind of amazing confluence of corporate interests and creative interests, which only happens once in a while.
We're talking with Brett Martin. His book, Difficult Men, is out in hardcover, paperback, and Kindle, and as I listened to it, audible.com. Behind the scenes of a creative revolution from The Sopranos and The Wire to Mad Men and Breaking Bad. And it really is a chronicle of the new era of television and how it's changed. And it's just fascinating. It's fascinating to read. We'll have more with Brett in just a little bit. Our show today brought to you by Lynda.com, Lynda.com. Learn what you want, when you want. They have over 2,000 high-quality courses, not videos. They've got thousands of videos, all for one low flat rate per month. You could learn photography. You could learn audio and video editing. You could learn software. You want to get better at OS X Mavericks? They've got a class. At Windows 8.1, they've got a class. And what's nice about these classes, they're very, very easy to get into. You go to lynda.com, and I'll show you how you could do this free for a week in a second. But you go to lynda.com and pick the subject you want, and then you can search through the transcript for the episode that is exactly the tip you want. Or you can watch the whole thing. You can watch it on your computer, on your portable device, your mobile phone, your tablet. You can switch and pick up on where you left off on another device. You learn at your own pace. It's great for somebody who wants to learn, off the job, how to do the job better. We have our editors all have lynda.com accounts if they want to work on Final Cut skills and things like that. New courses all the time. Lighting design for video production just came out. That's an awesome one. Responsive typography. I don't even know what that would be, but Google Analytics tips if you want to learn how to do SEO, Google AdWords essential training, and the instructor. One of the reasons I love Lynda, we were very happy to have a relationship with them, is we know many of the instructors, great people like Bert Monroy and Peter Krogh and Derek Street, Derek Story, all the photographers that I know will teach you how to get better at photography, how to get better at Lightroom, how to get better at Photoshop. All the content is curated and produced with very high production values. These are not homemade YouTube videos. This is the best. Lynda.com. And they have business stuff, too. Things like resume writing, negotiating techniques. So you're going to find a course that's right for you. I want you to visit and find out. 7 days, the run of the place for free. Normally it's just $25 a month, but $37.50 a month if you want the premium plan. But for 7 days, you get everything. If you visit lynda.com/triangulation, that's lynda.com/triangulation. I've known Linda Wyman since she started out writing books on web design. In fact, we used to have her on the screensavers all the time. And this site is just, it's her spirit. It's wonderful. Free for 7 days. Try it. You will learn at lynda.com. And if you're an employer, you should do as we do and offer your employees lynda.com memberships. It's a very useful way to have them brush up their skills. Our guest is Brett Martin. He's the author of Difficult Men. Writes for, as feature writer for GQ. He does food and travel, too. Which do you like better, food writing or TV writing?
Whichever I'm not doing.
I would take, yeah, right. the one I'm not working on.
Exactly.
Good answer.
But both are very nice to, both you can't complain about, let's put it that
no
way.
No kidding.
Not in mixed company anyway.
Yeah, but you did such a great job. I really did feel like I was a fly on the wall, not just at Deadwood, but even going all the way back to The Sopranos. The history of The Sopranos is quite interesting. I mean, it really was the first show to launch this golden age of television. How did it happen?
Well, David Chase, as we talked about a little bit before, had been in television a very long time. He had been grown progressively more disillusioned and self-loathing about working in television. He had this unusual situation, which is somewhat unique to television, which is that you fail and you can make a very nice living never having a show on the air.
Writing pilots that never get produced.
Exactly. And he had a reputation as a bit of a pain. But also one of these great talented writers who the most talented underused writer in Hollywood.
You say that often he would write a pilot and hope it didn't get picked up because he didn't want to write another episode. He just wanted to do the one, take his big bucks and go.
Well, right, or that they would be tryouts for movies. This was his great hope was that he would produce a pilot, it would fail as a television show, and that they would then, because they'd already spent that much money, give him an extra little bit, and he could finish it, and it would be a feature film. And that never really happened.
In fact, I thought that was what they wanted with The Sopranos, right? He wanted that to be ultimately be a movie.
That was one of his fantasies, was that it would be a movie. And it began as one of his agents suggesting doing The Godfather for television, which, of course, was a sort of very, very bad idea that quickly became... he had been making notes. I mean, an enormous amount of this came out of his childhood in northern New Jersey. His mother, who was an extraordinarily difficult character, very much as Livia Soprano, became.
Tony's mom in the show was David Chase's mom.
Essentially, yes. I mean, as close as you can ever say. I don't believe that she ever tried to have him killed, but other than that, I think you're pretty much right on. Yeah. And she, of course, is one of the great dark comic, horrifying characters that has ever been on television.
Yeah, Nancy Marchand.
Nancy Marchand, who did a wonderful, brilliant job. And really, that was the show. The show was about a mobster who was having panic attacks and whose mother and uncle tried to kill him. That was the nut of the show. That was the movie that would have become that he fantasized about making.
But this really encapsulates the whole thing because 2 hours of Tony versus 86 hours of Tony.
I agree completely, yeah.
It would maybe at best Goodfellas. But
right.
But instead you have and you point out it's not a mob drama, it's a family drama. It's almost a family comedy in the first season. I found myself laughing. I watched it again recently and I forgot how funny it was, especially in the beginning.
Well, first of all, let me just say generally that every show I write about, I think, is very funny. And I think that if I had to point to one distinguishing characteristic of the best shows, the best dramas of the last 20 years, the 10 years, they've all had healthy doses of comedy.
Interesting.
And it's the first thing I look for. You know, last night I was watching True Detective and they had their first joke 4 hours in and I breathed a sigh of relief because I liked the show, but I feared that... we were never going to be able to crack a smile during it. Anyway, that's a bit of a digression.
That's a good point. And by the way, I do love True Detective, but it was starting to... I didn't know why, and you've catalyzed it. It was starting to drag me down.
Yeah.
I was getting depressed.
I need it. I think that they... I mean, The Wire, which is, I think a lot of people...
Great show.
as a kind of homework. I mean, perhaps the best show that's ever been on TV. Can be hysterically funny. Deadwood too, despite its ponderous language, is can be very funny. And certainly David Chase said to me that he was never 100% sure whether The Sopranos was a drama or a comedy. In many ways it was Father Knows Best. Just again, to quote David Chase, Father Knows Best how to kill people.
Although, as you point out, there was in the third episode of the first season, a real do-or-die moment for The Sopranos. The episode's called College. In it, Tony Soprano, the premise is a very, Father Knows Best kind of premise. Tony Soprano takes his daughter, Meadow, on a tour of colleges so she knows which to apply to. In the middle of it, meets an informer up in Maine, who has been in the witness protection program and kills him extremely brutally on camera, a 30-second strangulation scene. Even HBO did not want to air this.
Right. It's one of those moments like Ozzie and Harriet sleeping in the same bed that, it's hard to imagine television before this. But it was as revolutionary a moment. It's as significant a moment in this golden age as ever been. I mean, considering that at that moment, the idea of having a character who looked like... HBO had already bitten the bullet and had an actor who looked like James Gandolfini doing terrible things on screen. Clearly not a nice guy. Clearly a new kind of hero, quote unquote. Even given that, when that script landed on HBO president Chris Albrecht's desk, he called David Chase and said, "We can't do this. This, you're killing us. We're finally getting some ratings. This will end us."
It was the fifth show in the series.
That's right. And it started out in the writers' room as a classic Brady Bunch goes to Hawaii. We want to
get out of New Jersey.
And actually, in terms of the other subplot of Tony's conflict between him being a family man and a family man with a capital F. It's a brilliant episode. But this moment at which HBO had to make the decision whether to go ahead with this, and David Chase had to stand his ground and make his case, really belongs in the pantheon of great creative moments, I think.
HBO said, "You have made us like this guy against all odds, because he is a mafioso, over the last four episodes, and now you're going to make him something horrific, and the audience is going to turn its back."
Exactly. And that had been, in HBO's defense, that had been the item of faith for, since television began, which is that we would not accept these kinds of characters in our homes. That what America wanted from television was easy narratives, good guys and bad guys, and comfort before bed. And that's why allowing that moment to go through, although adulterized just a tiny bit by making him a worse guy than was in the original script, which is a compromise that
the guy he's killing.
They made the snitch a terrible person,
right?
Yeah, they show him selling drugs to kids, and honestly, it's probably the last compromise on that level that The Sopranos made, but it doesn't diminish what that moment meant, which is that suddenly you could have a different kind of protagonist, and what happened was that people didn't turn their back on it, and within a handful of years, you have Dexter, which is. and you have
a serial killer hero.
and you open the floodgates to this kind of character that really dominated certainly the 2000s on television.
That is the first of the difficult men you talk about in the book. They are difficult heroes for sure, and yet we love them. Walter White in Breaking Bad. It's really interesting to see 15 years later. Or maybe less, how Walter White in Breaking Bad can really be so awful. I mean, his story arc gets lower and lower and lower. And as season after season goes by, people love it more and more and more. And by the time of the last episode, and it's still recent enough that we don't want any spoilers, so I won't give you any. Although it is arguably the best last episode of all of these shows, I think. You love this guy, right?
Well, you love him.
He's horrible.
I mean, he's as bad. Yeah, that's the, you know, in some ways the game that The Sopranos played implicitly about how far we were willing to go with Tony. You know, are we going to continue, you know, what the ways in which he tested our affection that we felt for him and feared him. And, you know, that was the explicit project in many ways of Breaking Bad, which Vince Gilligan has often said was bringing Mr. Chips and turning him into Scarface. And and so
what an arc.
At each stage, that's what, yeah, you were being tested. Are you rooting for him now? Right. Are you rooting for him now? And you know, I would argue that the show was better than just whether you rooted for him or not. That the answer was that you felt both ways about him. Yes. One of the things that made that show so amazing, and all of these shows, and The Sopranos too, is how queasy it made you, mm-hmm. To relate to Walter White, to relate to Tony, to want them to succeed, even though if it meant doing the most horrible things. And it made you ask a lot of questions about yourself as a viewer, much more than, I mean, that's what art's supposed to do. That would be my argument for how this rises to the level of great art.
Yeah. It's the complexity of real life as opposed to the silly simplicity of traditional television.
Exactly. Exactly.
And as the chat room is pointing out, it's true, anti-heroes are nothing new, going back to Jimmy Cagney, but that was in movies. And in television, this was a brand new thing. And I think you argue very well that it's what it freed television to become something in some ways even a greater medium than movies for storytelling. You liken it to Dickens.
Right. I'm not alone in doing that. I certainly, The Wire explicitly does what Dickens did, which is to have this, to portray a city, a moment in social history at many different levels, with an active social activist agenda, and more importantly, rise to the level of great dramatic mythical storytelling while accurately portraying the world around it. You know, Dickens wrote, you know, I spent a little bit of time in the book talking about, you know, looking at Dickens tearing his hair out over the pressures of writing these books serially, which is actually, you know, which, believe me, you can just see those quotes repeated directly by showrunners about midway through a season when you know the producer's knocking down the door for the next script. But yes, the you know, it's become a little bit of a cliche, but for a reason, that they are, these are like chapters in a novel. Now, I don't think it's going to do anything to the novel, which has had legs, and I certainly don't think it's going to do anything to film, which probably will survive this. But I do think that if you were looking for adult storytelling in the last 10 years, you didn't go to the multiplex. You went to television.
It's created in me, at least, a dissatisfaction with film that I'd never felt before, as much as a film buff as David Chase was. But the space to tell this story and the complexity and the storylines. Now, sometimes it can be overblown. Somebody says in your book, it's just a soap opera. And
right.
You say, yeah, if soap opera, if it had incredible art direction, superb cinematography, brilliant writing. Yeah, it's just a soap opera.
Right. You mean a bunch of stuff that happens?
I mean, yeah, a bunch of stuff that happens.
I mean, I've always thought one of the sillier criticisms, because, yeah, they're all soap operas until they rise to the level of great storytelling.
Right.
Yeah, you know, I remember at some point midway through, you know, realizing, yeah, people die and people hook up in various, you know, various combinations and all the things that are, you know, or would be soap operatic if they're handled poorly, are the stuff of great drama.
Yeah.
When done well.
And I feel like I go to a movie and I'm even going in, I go, you know, they only have 90 minutes to 2 hours to tell this story. There's no way they're going to have a complete, fully fleshed out story arc like The Sopranos or The Wire or Mad Men or any of these shows. And I'm a little bit more disappointed. And now, and I think I'm not alone, I consume these, I don't know what you call these shows, but I consume these television shows like candy. I can't wait for the next one when HBO announces a new series, although HBO is disappointed with a number of series. But I always have the highest hopes. It's very exciting. I think it's almost a new medium.
Well, think how weird that is, though, that you root for, you don't root for Paramount. Like, you know, no. Oh, Paramount has a new movie out. Yeah. I mean, you know, I feel like I'm, I mean, so successful have they been, AMC, a handful of these brands.
Yes.
In establishing their credibility that we go into them with giving them absolute every benefit of the doubt. That they're going to be good, and that in itself is kind of a remarkable thing.
That we
root for these corporations.
I don't root for NBC.
No, exactly. And you don't root for Farrah Straus-Giroux has a new book. That's probably good. And I think that also speaks to the kind of community that this television has ensured, which is remarkable, and I don't think it's an accident that the rise of this kind of television has paralleled the rise of social media and of the internet and ways to experience it as a group in some ways. And so there's a kind of intimacy that happens because it's in our house, because we are sharing it with this greater community, that there's this feverish desire to love things, I think a lot of shows get overpraised because of it. But better that in some ways than us all being cynical and not having exciting cultural moments to look forward to.
No, it's really true. I mean, if you after Mad Men airs, I go to The Atlantic and read their analysis of it, and it has become more. It's taken a life of its own. And also, do you think it has something to do with the ability to binge watch?
Yeah, well, absolutely. That's become this kind of default way of watching these shows. It's funny because I would have benefited from being a little more inclined to do that myself because I had so much television to catch up with when I was working on this book. Yes, obviously that has become that phenomenon of watching show after show after show. Is and being able to catch up with it, being able to go back and rewind, whether you watch it on DVD or DVR, and really bore deep in multiple viewings, has a lot to do with it. You know, I would argue that what has gotten less attention is the ways in which it actually reinforces the opposite, which is if you happen to be watching it in real time, like True Detective, I'm watching True Detective week by week. That's a kind of suspense and delayed gratification
right. That
is very rare these days.
Yeah.
You know, that you can't, you know, to actually have to wait for and be forced to watch it because if you don't watch it on Sunday night, you can't go on Twitter.
I actually watched True Detective at 9 o'clock on Sunday night last night.
That's very
first time I've done that with a show in ages.
Yeah.
But I had to see it. I couldn't wait.
And you would be unable to go out and talk to people the next day. I mean, you know, perhaps True Detective hasn't risen to that level yet, but certainly at the end of Breaking Bad,
you had to
lock the doors, pull down the shades. If you know, if you didn't watch it in real time, and you didn't want things spoiled, you were pretty much a cripple.
That's right. I was in Europe when it happened and I had to not look spoilers, no spoilers. That has given rise. Spoilers, the word spoiler has been around for a long time, but boy, has given a lot of meaning to that word. And because we do live internet broadcasting all the time, we talk about this stuff all the time, we have to be very cognizant of what we say and don't say. People are, they will be brutal if you spoil a show for them. And I guess I kind of understand that.
Yeah, I don't. I mean, I'm glad I'm not in the position of doing it, or I'm very careful myself, but it's, I mean, I do understand it. I mean, you're absolutely right. You know, this is again, that speaks to how exciting it is and how, you know, how surprising it can be. But you know, I don't know exactly do you have a rule of thumb and an amount of time that
we have not come up with one. I still am reluctant to tell people that about Darth Vader and Luke. But
whoa,
I didn't say anything.
Easy. All right.
So maybe there is no statute of limitations on spoilers. We've actually spent time arguing about that.
Yeah, I err on the side of longer.
Yeah.
Honestly, I
well, do, you know, if you write about this in GQ, you're going to hear from a lot
absolutely,
of people.
Absolutely.
So House of Cards is a very good example of a decision made by Netflix to release an entire season at once. And Dana Brunetti, the producer, is a friend of the network, and he said he was very glad. One of the reasons they went with Netflix is because he liked that instead of weekly releases. He liked the binge watching. And, you know, it's paid off because season two, which is just around the corner, the drumbeat for that is phenomenal. Same with Game of Thrones. The drumbeat, you can't go on social media without seeing links to the trailers and people excitedly talking about it. The marketing does itself.
Yeah. Well, I think that goes to what we were just saying about, I mean, there is, I mean, we want these experiences, you know, as soon as Breaking Bad ended, you know, it was, what's the next thing? You know, what are we going to look forward to? What's Sunday night going to be? I think it's, you know, we've grown accustomed. It's a wonderful position to be in that we believe that good work is going to come down the pike.
It is a human urge, though. And I think when I and others were worried when people stopped watching television live that water cooler moment the next day. Did you hear what Johnny Carson said last night? That we were going to lose that sense of, we're all watching Ed Sullivan on a Sunday night and watching the Beatles. We were going to lose that sense of national community, and you know what, we didn't, because it's such a human instinct. We've now got it, but it's just in a different format. These shows,
right? I think you're right. I mean, you know, things like, I think you could feel it most intensely during that last run up of Breaking Bad.
God, yes.
That what we were watching, you know, that it felt like a live event. It felt like the Super Bowl or something like that. It was the kind of cultural moment that they said didn't happen anymore.
Yep.
And that's a great thing.
I want to talk a little bit about the other side of it. We talked about how hard it is for the writer and the writer made showrunner and the pressure, but the actors too, in these very long 86 episodes of being Tony Soprano, took a real toll on James Gandolfini. Let's talk a little bit about that when we come back. Brett Martin is our guest. His book, I cannot recommend it more highly. I just loved it. And it's one of, by the way, of a number of books now talking about this kind of topic. It's one of the best. I've read them all, you know, Pictures of a Revolution and so forth. His book is called Difficult Men, Behind the Scenes of a Creative Revolution, from The Sopranos and The Wire to Mad Men and Breaking Bad. And I think the thing that makes this book so great for me is the stories about the writer's room, about the stuff that goes on, the drama that goes on behind the scenes of the dramas we love, but also the great understanding and analysis, as you've heard during this show, of what this means culturally. It really is a huge cultural shift. We've got more in a bit. I want to talk about Gandolfini. But first, a word from Personal Capital, our fine sponsor. Bill Harris of Personal Capital was a guest on this very show about a year ago. He had been the CEO of PayPal and of Intuit. They did Quicken and Mint. And he was telling me about this whole idea. He mentioned this startup, Personal Capital. I joined it, and I've been using it for a year, and I'm a big fan. I want to encourage you to give it a try, too. You know, I don't care where you, what stage you are in your financial life. You're just starting out. You've got your first 401k, or you're coming, as I am, to the end of your career, maybe not life, but career, and you've got to start worrying about your retirement and how are you going to live. Financial planning is a very important thing and a very easy one to just kind of space out over, especially when you're young. This is a great way to do it without a lot of work, a lot of effort, or spending any money. It's absolutely free. PersonalCapital.com. It's a free and secure tool that solves really the two biggest barriers to growing your wealth. First of all, keeping track of all your things, your charge cards, your loans, your mortgage, your stocks, your 401k. They're all on different sites, different usernames. This brings it all together in beautiful graphic detail. But the second is, if you're paying somebody to management, it's so easy to pay too much, to have too much in commissions and fees. Personal Capital brings all your accounts and assets to a single screen on your computer, or they have great apps for phones or tablets, Android and iPhone. Real-time intuitive graphs show you exactly what you're doing, shows you if you're overpaying in fees, how to reduce those fees. You get advice that's tailored to exactly your situation, and it's absolutely free. Signing up just takes a minute, and it will pay big dividends. I love it. I've been using it for a year. Very happy. PersonalCapital.com/triangulation. Personal Capital is free and the smart way to grow your money. PersonalCapital.com/triangulation. Brett Martin is our guest. He writes for the New Yorker, Vanity Fair, GQ. I mistakenly called you a TV writer when I first mentioned this book. He's a feature writer, folks. Get it straight. Although he also writes about travel and food. So he writes about all the things I care most about. His book, Difficult Men, is a must read and is now in paperback, so it's a good time to talk about it. I know the book came out right about when James Gandolfini died in Italy. He was shockingly young, in his early 50s. And as a result, you spent a lot of time talking about him. You talk in the book, he was still alive at the time, about how difficult it was to be Tony Soprano.
Right. Well, I think that's the flip side of the kinds of heroes that that rose to prominence during this time, and also the length of these shows and the kind of seriousness of them is that any actor. I had the same kind of conversation with Bryan Cranston, who's a completely different kind of actor than James Gandolfini was. But even he said, you know, it is an enormously straining thing to do. Nobody probably experienced more strain than James Gandolfini.
What is the work day like? I mean, how is it the amount of work?
Well, it was a style. I mean, certainly early on, Tony was in every scene. I mean, it's extremely hard. I mean, grueling work to be, first of all, just physically, just to be on set all that time, to memorize nightly the kinds of, remember those therapy scenes in the early days of The Sopranos were, you know, pages and pages and pages of monologue, essentially.
He'd have to come on the set and memorize that.
He'd have to go home and memorize that. He'd be on set all day. I mean, he would call David Chase on the way home, you know, midway through that first season and ask him, you know, why are you killing me? Why are you killing me? and you have to remember that it wasn't light comedy. It was an incredibly difficult kind of character to inhabit. And he was the kind of, there are certain actors, Cranston is one of them, who seem to have this ability to turn it on and turn it off. There are other actors who have to go there, so to speak. And Jim Gandolfini was one of those. It took, to some extent, descending into Tony's psyche to become Tony. And that's a tough place to be. He had his own demons that had nothing to do with Tony. I mean, you know, the other side of it is that Tony's depth and his frightening, you know, what made Tony scary and touching and everything that Tony was came out of Gandolfini too, but they together it was a tough combination and it became a real issue as time went on. He would stop showing up on set, occasionally disappear. I open the book with a long story about a time that he disappeared for 3 days and really everybody thought that he was gone then.
They just stopped production.
You stop production, yeah, absolutely, and that's like stopping, I'm reaching for a metaphor. It's stopping a carrier ship, you know. I mean, we're talking about hundreds and hundreds of people, with tons of gear. I think in this case, they were shooting a scene with they'd shut down an airport in Westchester to shoot a scene with a helicopter, and that's the kind of thing that would happen. And then he would be back, and he would be terribly apologetic, and he would buy everybody on the set watches, and it was a difficult thing. This is the thing that I can say, and I said this a lot in the after he died, is that to a man and a woman, the people whose lives he made most difficult were all people who spoke about him with the greatest compassion and tenderness, and the people who had the most reason to resent his behavior really loved him the most, and I take that as a sign that they understood the toll that this was taking on him.
Yeah, he was a very beloved and great actor.
He's tremendous. What he did with that role. I said earlier that watching him work, I'll tell my grandkids that I watched Michael Jordan play basketball and I watched Gandolfini cook. I watched Jacques Pepin cook and I watched Gandolfini act. The depth of feeling and nuance that he brought to that role can't be overestimated, how important that was to what The Sopranos became.
It's interesting. Little Stevie Van Zandt was cast first in The Sopranos and for a while considered as Tony Soprano.
Right.
Would have been very famous for being in Bruce Springsteen's E Street Band, but he had never acted. and yet the character he created, Silvio, in The Sopranos is one of the most beloved characters. Paulie, too.
Oh, yeah.
And Paulie was a real kind of, not a made man, but he was a little sketch himself.
Yeah, Tony Sirico.
Tony Sirico
was one of the great legends of what knowing again, I don't want to put they're too close together, but to talk to Tony Sirico it was very similar to the experience of talking to Paulie Walnuts. So let's just leave it like
that. That's scary. As an example, Tony did his own hair. Those beautiful gray wings. He would get up very early, you say, and do his hair for hours.
Nobody else was allowed to touch the hair. The hair was his thing, and he came in absolutely in costume prepared, down to the smell of Drakkar Noir.
Paulie Walnuts.
He was in some ways Paulie Walnuts.
When Paulie's hair gets messed up. I don't know if it's in the Pine Barrens episode, but he's visibly upset.
Right, because that was part of Tony's... part of Paulie's character is that he was super clean, and but at the same time, I don't want to diminish. It was a great acting job too,
yes.
And I think that there's an example of something that happens. If The Sopranos only lasts one season, Paulie's a bit of a comic relief character. I think by the end, he had become much more than that. Something very, very deep.
Good point. True for all of them.
Yeah, absolutely.
You talk a little about Edie Falco, Carmela Soprano, who had a very different style from Gandolfini. She could come in. Do her bit, leave. Didn't seem to take the show with her. Gandolfini was living that show every minute that he was working on it.
Right. Well, bear in mind also that if he's walking down the street, what does he look like?
Right. Hey, Tony!
He didn't have the opportunity to hide that an Edie Falco did. Edie Falco doesn't, she puts on a baseball cap, takes off the Carmela nails, she is, can blend in with the crowd.
Right.
Tony... Jim Gandolfini was a big guy and a guy who, again, looked very much like Tony and lived in New York. And at a time when, I quote somebody in the book, Terrence Winter, who's actually went on to run Boardwalk Empire. And he talks about going to Atlantic City with those guys at some point at the very height of the phenomenon. And he said it was like being with, the Beatles if all the Beatles were Jim Gandolfini.
Yeah. Yeah, I think that was the season.
You can understand what the pressures might have been.
Yeah, no kidding. Let's talk about the. We got to wrap it up. We're running out of time, and I hate to stop because this book is full of so many fascinating, interesting stories, and I don't want to stop with The Sopranos. We could talk about The Wire, David Simon, who was a writer's writer, a newspaper journalist who never fell out of love with Baltimore, and his entire oeuvre is Baltimore stories from homicide, life on the streets. To The Corner, to The Wire. We could talk about Breaking Bad. I'd love to hear about Brian. Well, all right, let's do it. A little bit about Bryan Cranston. How did he deal with being Walter White?
I think he was more like Edie Falco in that he's, he when I talk to him, he talks about it being, he has an ability to be Walter White, do the most intense possible scenes, and then step back out of it and get behind the camera. And pretty much all the cast members that I talked to agreed that that was the case. Even he, though, and I talked to him right before the end, I think they were just finishing the final season, admitted that, he was ready to leave this character behind.
Oh,
and
God,
and
yes.
There was, there's a scene, I think this is not a spoiler, there's a scene where he's watching a young woman die in an earlier season. I think it was the last scene that they had shot of that season, and they had a big party afterwards, and he sat there and could not stop crying.
Really?
From watching that scene. I think know which scene I'm referring to.
I do, yeah.
So it's hard, I think that... Wow. I think that, I think you to live with. I mean, the same was true of Idris Elba who played Stringer Bell.
God, he's so good.
The Wire, McNulty from The Wire, Dominic West.
Both of whom are British.
Yeah,
it's like you see Dominic West in the newsroom or whatever it is, the new BBC show he's in.
Yeah,
it's like what. Wait a minute. You're McNulty. Stop that. Or Idris Elba was a beautiful cultured accent.
Absolutely.
Fascinating.
But it is. That's one of the things it's this monster. It's this great creative undertaking. I mean, and it sort of sweeps everybody up. These shows are rolling along, and I think I try to give a sense of this in the book, it is this great kind of upswelling of creative energy that brings everybody along with it. And hopefully that makes for some interesting stories.
Oh, man, does it. Let's talk about, we'll wrap it up with the final episode of The Sopranos, which was very controversial. And some might even say tarnished a great 6 years run, 85 great episodes, and then that. Why did David Chase end it that way? What was the reaction? And now, here we are almost 10 years later. What's your thinking on it now? What's his thinking on it now?
Well, I have come to believe that that was the only possible ending. I was a fan early of it, and I've become
more of a fan since. Those who haven't seen it, it was a very, no spoilers, but it's a very ambiguous ending, much like, say, the ending of Inception, where you're left up in the air. You don't know what happened. I think in hindsight, after much analysis, we probably can guess what happened, but you don't know what happened, and it is very abrupt. In fact, the show goes to black quite abruptly, and it was David Chase's original plan just to leave it black while the credits rolled. No music, nothing. Okay, now that I think that's enough to understand that something happened. It was a very abrupt ending.
I think he comes as close as he's ever come in my book to saying what happened, but I actually think that that's a bit of a red herring, because let's start at the beginning, which is that the notion of ending a television show, of course, for most of television history has been a non-starter, because shows ended when they didn't have enough viewers, and it wasn't a story that had an arc, and you just they went off the air. Maybe you had MASH. I mean, there were once in a while there was an event, but this is a new problem in some ways. The idea that there is that the story is going to end in any kind of satisfying way. David Chase, throughout the entire series, insisted on not giving the audience easy catharsis, easy conclusions. You know, whether it's the Russian from Pine Barrens never showing up or you know, other characters suddenly disappearing, you know, that was very much his narrative philosophy, which is that this is a slice of life and it's not going to, and it's going to be like life. It's not going to give you an easy answer. And the question was, how do you reconcile that? How do you feel good about yourself at the end of the day while wrapping this show up? And if you consider those two imperatives in a man who's, you know, if nothing else, has serious artistic integrity, there aren't a lot of solutions left. And I've come to believe, talking to him and watching it over and over again, that it ended in the only way it could possibly end, which is a kind of statement that an artistic statement about what stories are like, that you're not going to necessarily get an ending.
Good.
And that, you know, life goes on. So that's my feeling about it. Of course, people went absolutely nuts at the time and thought that their TVs had broken, and there's a lot of out there still. But I think it's actually aged. I think more and more people have come around to what I'm saying. Just informally, I get that feeling.
I think you're absolutely right.
It doesn't sound like you have.
No. I have, and I think you're absolutely right. That in hindsight, it was the right way to. I think we'd come off an era where the finale of MASH was the quintessential series ender. Everybody gets in a helicopter and flies home.
Right.
And I admire the artistic pure integrity that David Chase had to say, I'm not going to give you a happy ending.
Right. Or gratify you. I mean, remember, we're talking about, you know, we've been watching this guy do terrible. We were talking earlier about he'd been doing terrible things for 80 hours. I'm not going to take you off the hook by watching him get punished
blown away.
Either.
Yeah,
exactly. You know, it's fine. I just quickly, Vince Gilligan, when I talked to him while he was writing the finale to Breaking Bad, which I won't spoil, but referred to the MASH ending as the model that the writers talked about in the writer's room, which is to say, sometimes the best ending is the ending that you've been expecting.
Yeah.
Which is that, you know, the entire problem of MASH for however 12 years it had run was, are these guys going to get to go home? And at the end of it, you find out if they're going to go home or not. So sometimes that's the right way to go too. And it's actually been fascinating to watch how everybody handles these endings differently. And we still have Mad Men to go, which is exciting.
I was going to ask you about the ending of Breaking Bad, and I guess I speak for the pedestrian audience that wanted a conclusion, and Sopranos left us hanging, but Breaking Bad, there was no bow untied, and no string left unraveled, and I kind of preferred that, because I can walk away saying, good, it is done.
Right.
And so just a thought. It's obviously these people are these are artists. Everybody involved, I think it should be clear by now, these are great artists.
Yeah.
And they're going to solve the problem differently. And they don't particularly care what Leo thinks or anybody else. They're going to do it artistically. But-
Right, and that's what's thrilling about it. You know, I found it strange. You know, I as a viewer, and by the time Breaking Bad was ending, I was just a viewer, not working on this book any longer. You know, I was ready for that. I had other thoughts about how Breaking Bad might end, but I was no more going to stick to them than I was right. at the end when I'm reading a novel to say, oh, I think
well, exactly.
this way. This was the story that Vince Gilligan yep. wanted to tell, and I was very happy to receive it that way.
He's taking us for a ride. It's his. He's the captain. He gets to pilot it.
Exactly.
Mad Men's an interesting story, too. We didn't really touch on Mad Men, but Mad Men is a very different kind of show where it's much more subtle. There, there's a lot of... pauses. It's not an action-heavy show. Right. It takes a lot of thinking, and I don't know if I want an end to Mad Men. It doesn't feel like it's going to end.
Well, I think in some ways Mad Men is the closest to The Sopranos. In other ways too, that it's the most like life. It does kind of wander at times.
It's a Don Tom Draper. Stoppard play, not a you know. I mean, it's.
It is, but it's, you know, it poses a lot of the same questions. You know, I think Don Draper is a miserable jerk.
Yeah.
In much the same way, and a kind of emotional terrorist in the same way that Tony's a real terrorist right. In his way. And, you know, I agree. I'm in some ways, I'm most fascinated by how Mad Men will end, because I think that Matt Weiner, who is its creator, is closest to David Chase in his, who was his mentor. Matt Weiner was, right. of course, a writer on The Sopranos. Closest to him in his misanthropy, in his sense of storytelling, and he's going to have to figure out a way to do this and, you know, separate himself from the master, which has been, you know, one of the weird behind the scenes subplots of the Mad Men throughout. I also think he's incredibly smart. Not a guy I'd want to work for, but a brilliant man, and I'm excited to see how he solves that puzzle.
Yeah, I guess it, you know, they're just different strokes. I mean, Vince Gilligan had an arc. He had an arc from day one. He knew where he was going with that show, and he gave us closure because that fit the arc. It was right. the entire arc. It doesn't feel like Mad Men has much of an arc at all. It feels like if the arc is the backbone of the history of the era, I guess. I don't.
Well, I think you could say is the mystery, the moral mystery is, you know, is Don Draper going to redeem himself? Is he
I think
going
we know
to
the
survive?
Answer to that.
Well, that's probably true, yeah. But is he going to survive the 60s? Is he going to survive
right.
his
time? Right.
Is he going to, you know, he's a man who you meet, you know, in one era and is trying to kind of make his way through the rubble of the 60s.
Yeah,
You know.
Fascinating stuff.
I like watching.
I mean, I can't. Oh, are you kidding? I'm glued to the set. Absolutely. Yeah. But I watch as much for the art direction as anything else.
Oh, it's gorgeous. And those are a lot of Sopranos. Well, you know, early on, at least, it was you know, there was a great Sopranos DNA in Mad Men. And yeah. I think that's the way to really understand it.
Yeah. Well, you'll understand it a lot better if you read Difficult Men. It's definitely the playbook for this whole third golden age of television. Which maybe I would disagree with that characterization. It doesn't feel like it is a successor to anything that went before it, but really a new medium being born, and a medium I pretty much know that everybody who's watching has discovered and is excited about.
Right.
Yeah, it's really amazing stuff. Brett, I thank you so much for your time, Brett Martin.
Thank you so much. This was really great. Let me just show you. If you send me your size, I will send you a.
There's a few people here in the office who would like me to have that.
Usually PAs are the most biggest fans of that.
A t-shirt that says Difficult Man. C'est moi. I wish. I would love to be the auteur of one of these Difficult Men. Who is the worst? Was it Milch?
Worst?
You'd least like to work for?
I don't want to work for any of them.
They're all
that's
crazy.
But they're all a little crazy, but they're all, but you know, again, and I think, and this is at the base, I tell some, there, it's pretty obvious if you read the book who I would least like to work for and most like to work for.
Yeah.
But they all, I mean, the in some ways, you know, their work speaks for itself.
It does.
That's my political answer.
Very nicely done. Well played, sir. Bret Martin's book, Difficult Men. You can also read him in GQ most recently, but also Vanity Fair. You do some good interviews. There's an interview with John Hamm. Mm-hmm. There's an interview with there's some good stuff. Got to go back and look at it. If you go to his website, a lot of it's there, brettmartin.org, BRETTMARTIN.ORG. Thank you, Brett.
Thank you so much.
Appreciate your time. We do Triangulation now at our new time, Mondays, 1 p.m. Pacific, 4 p.m. Eastern Time, 2100 UTC. Please tune in and watch live. The chat room, a big part of this show, because your questions and your thoughts help me understand what you want to know from our guests. So live is great. But if you can't, on-demand audio and video of all of our shows, always available at our website, twit.tv. In this case, twit.tv/TRI. We put it on YouTube. We have a Triangulation channel, youtube.com/triangulation. And, of course, you can subscribe. In fact, you should subscribe, and you'll get every episode that way automatically. iTunes has it, Xbox Music, and all those places. Thanks for joining us, and we'll see you next time. Next week on Triangulation. Not next week, 2 weeks. Because we don't have a show. Next week is President's Day. Daniel Suarez talks about his new novel, Influx. I am very excited. We love this new novel. It comes out February 20th. We'll have the scoop on Triangulation. I'll see you then. Bye-bye.